Hi, Tim. Welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you for having me.
Look, Tim, the government says these laws were needed after the Bondi attack, and there's been a lot of criticism. We'll get into that. But I just want to start with getting an understanding of how these laws are actually supposed to work. So if you can just tell me briefly, step by step, how the government would now go about designating a group as a hate group.
Well, it's a hard question to answer because the laws are a little bit vague, a little bit broad in terms of what they can do. To put it at a very high level, essentially, in consultation with ASIO, the Home Affairs Minister basically needs to be satisfied that members of the group or the group itself has participated in hate crimes. But the hate crimes component of that is very broad, and it actually brings into federal law legislation from states and other territories around the country. So the concern the CCL has, which is that does this in a way that doesn't specifically outline those laws. So it really is up to the state and territory, and it's not clear whether or not the laws that apply in one state would then apply to another. So if the minister was satisfied, then they could designate that a hate group. The concern that goes from that as well is then that we don't have an ability to appeal the information that minister has used to make that decision because there's no access to procedural fairness.
I mean, the government described it as there's a set of criteria. It's not like they can just wave a wand.
No, but when we have a law that specifically says that they don't have to consider like procedural fairness in that decision, it's hard to say that it isn't just that as well.
Just explain that. What's procedural fairness?
So these laws, when a government minister or a government department makes a decision, what we expect as a community and what normally happens is the status quo is an expectation that every person will have the right that their decision that relates to them is made with due process, a chance to respond perhaps, that the minister, if they've got the power to make the decision, has properly read the materials before them. These laws, as they're on the books, do not say that. So while ASIO might have to put some information together to meet a criteria, there isn't a requirement for the minister to actually procedurally consider that material. Or let me put it another way. If we were to challenge whether they had, that's just not an available option to us.
Would people have to go to the courts?
Yeah, if you wanted to appeal this decision, you would have to take it to a court. But even if you were taking it to a court, you would have a law there on the books that says they actually weren't required to procedurally consider this information.
So there's some expanded powers there, basically, for the government. If a group is designated a hate group, what happens? Do individuals get charged?
Yes.
What are the consequences?
Essentially, these laws do have criminal charges related to being a member of a group or associated with this group. And if you happen to be a migrant in the community or have some visa, there's also powers that relate to the Home Affairs Minister being able to cancel visas, et cetera, make decisions around that as well. The same with if you want to come to the country. So there's a very broad range of powers about what the minister can and can't do with respect to whether you're associated with these groups. The real problem is whether or not this group has committed conduct related to the hate group. Those laws are so broad that it gets really hard to define what exactly that looks like when it comes to whether or not your behaviour or conduct is falls foul of those laws.
So let's talk a little bit about that then in terms of who might be roped in. The Attorney General, Michelle Rowland, was quizzed in the interview on the ABC about whether these laws would cover people expressing criticism, for example, of the Israeli government.
If a group is saying Israel is engaged in genocide or they're saying Israel should no longer exist, that is not enough for that group to be banned.
Well, again, that would depend on the other evidence that is gathered, David. So I would be reluctant to be naming and ruling in and ruling out specific kinds of conduct that you are describing here.
But surely we all need to know what will be.
What did you think when you heard her response?
I was pretty alarmed by it. I mean, this is a very experienced solicitor, our top attorney, the Attorney General is the leading lawyer in the country, and she could not answer that question. Now, I know why she couldn't answer the question, because the laws are so broad and encompassing. But that rubber, the issue that I think David Spears took her to when she was being pressed on the issue about Israel and the criticism of the state, is part of the issue. They're so broad, these laws, the vilification laws that it draws in from the state are so broad as well sometimes, that it really does risk some of these conversations we're having in the community now, for instance, the Israel-Palestine debate and discussion. it really does risk those criticisms of a nation state being brought into racial vilification type speech, which is being outlawed, and then, yeah, being captured by that.
I mean, Rowland was saying other factors would have to be satisfied. She was one of the government ministers trying to say it's not just going to be one element. Did that give you any sense of comfort?
No, not really. And I guess it comes back to that question about checks and balances. When we have laws that are put on the books deliberately to remove those procedural fairness, those abilities to appeal and review decisions, this is, you know, 2026 now. We're well past conversations around just trust us, we'll get this right. When it comes to executive power and legislative power, we must have procedural fairness rights at the centre of these decisions. And that wasn't, as a part of her conversation, that wasn't clear on the laws. And I think that's a big part of it as well. She couldn't articulate the answer because the laws aren't clear. They're quite vague. You know, we have to have understandable laws for them to be used in the community and for the community to adhere to them. And in that vagary, in that gap, we have silence. We have a community that doesn't speak because it doesn't know what's being outlawed. And the risk is that a government might overstep and suppress particular conversations.
A lot of what's been said about this is that the laws were rushed. Mm. Did the government consult your organisation at all?
No, I mean, we put in a submission, but the starting point for us and the alarm was, I mean, CCL was responding to some pretty significant regressive laws in the state of New South Wales, and some of us were on deck, but we had the federal government put these laws in with 3 days for response initially. That was an extraordinary turnaround for laws that touch across democratic rights. But they then changed the laws in consultation with the coalition and passed what they said on one hand was more narrow laws, but was actually more expansive in that it brought in state-based vilification laws as well and gave really no chance for community to consult. You know, I saw that Senator David Pocock doing what he could to consult with, you know, members of the community, and I'm sure there are others, but broadly speaking, there was no consultation on these further laws. These are the laws that touch across speech, association, originally religion, and yet we had a government that just sort of gallivanted along with their proposals without consideration. We can't be assured that they've got the balance right when community hasn't been heard on this.
Given the laws have now passed and you've looked at them, no doubt you've read the legislation, do you have a sense of clarity about whether people who are now protesting and criticise governments like those of Benjamin Netanyahu or China or other human rights abuses could end up being designated a hate group?
Yeah, it's not clear from what I can see. And look, I mean, strategically, the CCL is no friend of the Nazi party or the Nazis in the community. But what I don't want to do is give them a win. You know, I don't want these laws to be challenged on a constitutional basis. And a really conservative group that the community hates or has a real problem with because of their attitudes, and I'm specifically referring to the Nazi party here, we don't want them to feel like they have some justification and win because laws have been so passed that are so aggressive. There's so many elements to this that should have been considered and more thought out. And I don't think those where we're here yet. So, and then even broader than that, absolutely. These laws are so broad, so vague that I just am not sure that it won't capture lots of our complex cultural, religious, ethnic aspects of our community.
Well, you mentioned Nazi groups.
Mm.
That was what the government said it wanted to do. That was the whole point of these laws. They said it repeatedly. This was to target neo-Nazi groups and Hizbut Tahrir. Do you think the laws effectively do that, at least?
I think, interestingly enough, at a state level, Premier Minns passed laws specifically targeting Nazi groups in Australia. These laws didn't do that. They were broader than that. They were broader to hate groups. I think that's part of the problem to a certain degree. You can't target a specific party, a specific group, because you risk it being constitutional. We don't want a Communist Party case type issue where it touches too strongly across freedom of association. But what they did instead was put such, I think, a really fuzzy line around what they were targeting that these laws didn't necessarily do that either.
So you're saying the government had to go broad in order to do this quickly?
That's right, and try to step it out what exactly they were targeting.
Of course, these laws have come in the wake of the Bondi attacks, and they also really wanted them to tackle anti-Semitism. Do you think they do that at all?
No, I don't think so. And what I really worry about is linking, as a lot of the rhetoric has done, these laws with the protests, the debates around Israel and Palestine with anti-Semitism, I think is unfair to the communities that are protesting and out there on the streets. I think that's really unfair, and I think it continues a trend of what we've seen from some of our political leadership, both at a state and federal level.
Just explain that a bit more, because the Executive Council of Australian Jewry have welcomed these laws. They clearly think they do something for anti-Semitism.
Look, I mean, I'm reminded of when Trump suggested using bleach to kill COVID in the veins. I mean, sure, yes, it might kill COVID, but it would also destroy the body that was in. Sure, it might silence anti-Semitism in a group that has been horrifically targeted by such a broad board attack, might welcome a silence. My concern is that these laws damage the democracy that they're being passed in. The community might say it's dealing with anti-Semitism, but so does telling everyone to shut up and be quiet. That doesn't actually get down to the rub of the issue, solving the hate that's in our communities. And I think it actually does the opposite. I think there's been such poor rhetoric from our leadership about making that distinction between anti-Semitism and legitimate criticisms of Israel, that we have a community that doesn't quite understand the distinction broadly. And I think there's a reaction when some parts of the community feel like they're being silenced as opposed to actually being heard or being allowed to express their views. That doesn't get us closer to social cohesion. That gets us closer to division that we can't actually address.
Foreign Minister Penny Wong said, it's not legislation designed to prevent differences of views and freedom of speech.
It's not designed to prevent political debate. What it is designed to do is to crack down on organisations which are seeking to incite hate crimes.
Does that reassure you?
It doesn't. It comes back to that issue. I think, you know, let's say, look, we've passed these laws that allow us to do just that, but trust us, we won't. I think the real approach is, could you not pass those laws? And we would really appreciate a government that shows the political leadership to actually have this complex conversation and deal with it well. Why do we need to invoke executive power to empower ASIO and the Australian Federal Police to come after Australian citizens criminally? You know, why couldn't we bring specific issues of debate in our community or divisions about particular terms, words, whatever, into a forum or a facility for, you know, conversations, debate, arbitration, maybe the Australian Human Rights Commission? You know, why didn't we start the conversation there? Why do we start the conversation with, let's use the police, let's use our executive power to stop any talk or potentially shut down this, you know, any complex conversation? You know, that doesn't empower the community to solve the problems themselves.
When you look at these laws now, do you think they would have stopped the Bondi terror attack?
I think that's the fundamental question. The answer to that question is no. There's been no link that's been made to hate speech to what's happened. Obviously, it was a hate-filled attack, but this doesn't get us a solution to that problem. And I think it undermines community trust that our government knows what it's doing and it's taking the right steps when it doesn't, in good faith, consult with them about the issues and also seek to address the specific problem. Yes, it's scary. Yes, it's really worrisome, but it doesn't help us process our grief and our anger about what happened by having someone take us down a path which I think is ultimately very regressive.
We'll be right back